close relationship with them and want to know how to achieve it. Here's your host, Ivory Lanoue, renowned angel communicator.
Do you want to know more about angels? Are you ready to level up your spiritual journey? Then you are going to love my Inner Circle and Patreon. Membership includes great benefits like virtual workshops, mentoring programs, topical videos, interesting posts, a supportive, like-minded community, discounted sessions with me, and access to a library of videos and posts on topics you care about, like angels, spirituality, healing, and personal growth. Join and begin your spiritual expansion today. That's the Angel Room Inner Circle on Patreon. Hi, thanks for joining me today. I have a guest, as you can see, and this is author Joe Singleton, and he wrote a book called Maradon, Buddha Rise, The Awakening. We're going to be talking about the karmic wheel of life, which is why I have the karmic wheel of life behind me. But I do want to say hello to my listeners that are in Rogersville, Tennessee. Thank you so much for supporting the show week after week. I really appreciate it. You must be telling your friends because the listenership there is rising by the week. Let's jump into this. I want to show you at the beginning, I'm with a background, it's kind of hard, but this is Joe's book. And I am still in the middle of reading it because I'm reading it slow. I could skim it. I'm a fast reader. But I'm really enjoying it, Joe. So I'm absorbing it. And, you know, we talk a lot on this podcast about reincarnation. We've talked about karma. That's why when we brought up some various topics we could discuss, I knew that this karmic wheel of life is a good fit for my show. So, Joe, I kind of just want to jump right. There's so much. There's six parts to this book. And I want to be sure we get to talk about all six parts today. So, let's start with this. Who is Mara? Mara of Maradon?
Mara is that character. If you look up, if you Google or whatever, samsara or samsaric wheel of life or karmic Buddhist wheel of life, you will see this wheel that kind of looks like what you have behind you. And behind it is this kind of red monster with his hands on the top and his feet on the bottom, kind of like he's kind of like the devil in Buddhist terms as it relates to Judeo-Christian kind of, you know, things. There's some similarities. He tempted the Buddha for a long time that, you know, but he is kind of this trickster. I see him as a trickster. If you read the book, I kind of frame him as a trickster who kind of spins the world around us to keep us kind of in this state. We're kind of forwards is backwards. What we think we want is what we don't really need. And what we really need, we don't think we want. So I see him kind of as a magician trickster kind of thing.
Okay. And then, and I appreciate that. And the other thing is, what is samsara? Because I've actually been reading about that before I knew about your book. And I think I talked about it a couple of episodes back, but we always have new people listening. So what is samsara and how does that relate to the world as it stands today?
Samsara is really just that. It's the world that we live in, right? It's Mara's kingdom in a way. And what I talk about in the book a little bit, it really crosses all cultural boundaries. You know, it represents the human condition, you know, whether we live in this country and we think this other country thinks a completely different way and we're completely different people than in the end, we're all, you know, parents of children and friends and family and all this kind of stuff. And we all suffer the human condition, you know, as it relates to kind of dharmic principles and the Four Noble Truths. You know, we all suffer deep down, and it kind of gets to the heart of that. You know, that samsaric wheel was something that really opened my mind. You know, I call this book A Ladder of Ascension of the Mind. It starts out, as you know, pretty heavy, you know, paints a pretty dark picture of the world, and then it kind of opens up and finishes with this meditation thing to kind of get us beyond these kind of samsaric principles. But the more I study it and the more I write about it, I'm working on volume 2 now, And I was thinking of a little metaphor the other day where, you know how you see a picture of the Earth from space and you see this beautiful blue ball? In that sight, I think for all of us, you know, inhabitants of Earth, it kind of represents an all-encompassing picture of this kind of beautiful water energy that we're all a part of. If you look at the wheel of samsara, in a way, it represents the same kind of thing, but us in it, like what transpires within this big ball that we're all spinning on, you know. And it's really cool. It's got, you know, there's higher levels and lower levels. I compare it a lot to, you know, in Western kind of Judeo-Christian mythology, like Dante's Inferno, where you have these kind of 12 rings of hell, you know, and some people are worse at the bottom and some ascend higher. But in the end, what samsara is, no matter how virtuous we are or how non-virtuous we are, we're all actually suffering these same kind of human conditions and just going around and around lifetime after lifetime, hundreds, thousands, millions of lifetimes sometimes, with no way out, really. And really what the Buddha did, if you read the Dhammapada, which my book is kind of a expanded treatise of the Dhammapada in Western terms, there is a little way out at the top of the wheel. We can talk about it. There's a little smoke ring and you see the Buddha up there and he's pointing to this little sign that represents the Four Noble Truths.
This
and
little tiny
the idea
exit.
Out, you know, we're hamsters on this wheel. The idea is to get off of this and ascend to some higher plane of existence, right? Almost like we're stuck in this trap, like hamsters on a wheel going round and round. That's what it represents to me.
And I think something you said is like so important. It's part of why we're stuck in this wheel is the otherism that's really prevalent in the world right now. This group versus us, this group versus us, when instead of thinking we're all human beings, we're all sharing this planet. But I think that does take some spiritual growth to get to that place. But the other thing is, I definitely do plan to talk about that little exit doorway that there is, because that's like a little ray of light, right? People need to know there's a way out of this.
It's kind of funny you said that, because a few people, when I was writing the book, I had some people kind of sampling and reading it. And one guy read the first part and he said, you've got to put, you've got to say there's a better way or there's a way out, because the first part, I always tell people, get through the first 30 pages. It's really heavy. It almost paints this dark picture. And I think maybe I painted it too heavy of thinking that, but that is exactly the point. I'm glad you hit on that, because that is exactly the point of this book, what the Buddha taught and all of that kind of stuff.
I didn't see it dark. What I saw was very just observational. I see that, like, I just kind of was able to step back and just read it and like, well, that's the facts of what it is now. But I didn't see it as being particularly dark or heavy. But I want to be sure we get all these parts covered, and there's so much. So, okay, so on to part two, the veil exposed. You talk about anxiety and how samsara is presented as this world where just a little bit of fear and anxiety within can go a long way towards impeding our personal enlightenment. And I know most of the people who watched and listened to my show are very interested in personal enlightenment. So tell us about that one-third rule of anxiety.
I love this rule, because if you think about it, you know, if we say in dharmic principles, a big part of dharma and what this is all about, what I call a 3D prism of ourself, is things are always, and this is kind of how that meditation at the end is structured. You know, we see things come into our life, whether it be a little thing or big things, you know, that we can kind of see them coming into our life, and then they arrive into our life, and then they depart from our life, right? It's this departing form of that 33% of the principle, right? If you think about it, a lot of anxiety, you know, whether we're young and we're getting our education and we're worried about the job we're going to get, or we meet our spouse and we buy a house and we're going to have a family. This comes up a lot. I'm a tarot reader as well, and I find this in all of the people that I read for. There's always something inside that we want things to be perfect and permanent, right? We're going to have this house and we've got our family and it's always going to be this way. But that's not what happens, right? The kids grow older and they leave and we're left with this emptiness, or the house isn't what we always, and we want to remodel it. And it seems like, you know, in our Western culture, we just want to rebuild and build and build and build.
And that's the source of that anxiety, is that you know, we want things to be permanent all of the time, at least the things that we'd really desire in life, but they're not. That's that whole thing of the Four Noble Truths, right? We all suffer, all things pass, suffering itself passes too. And the good news is that mindfulness and understanding that all things pass sort of enlighten us. So it's kind of having that vision. If we understand that our lives, and this is what I try to put forth in meditations through balance of chakras, is that, you know, I know these new things are coming. I've got these things here, and some of these things are leaving, right? And if I understand that up front, maybe we can go straight to the core of the problem, the fear of death, right? I had a tarot reading the other day, and a singer, dancer on a cruise boat, just fearing death. So she's 20 something years old, right? You know, and look, that's going to happen. We've got a sick dog right now, and it's the saddest thing in the world, but it happens, you know. And the 33% rule is that we let that 33%, you know, that's kind of what causes the fear and anxiety. And in my equation there, to sum it up really shortly, is well, if stuff's coming 33% of the time and I've got my stuff, that's 66% of the time I should be happy, right? But it's not that way. That 35% almost wrecks all of that, because it all transfers to that worrying of that. I was in sales for a long time, and I had a manager one time who told me, you know, the fear of loss far outweighs the potential for gain. So when people make a decision, I've sold software to doctors, I've sold cars, you know, people really fear making these choices and these decisions, right? When you think about, you know, what it all really comes down to, especially in what we do from, you know, whether it be tarot or readings or however we help people, is overcoming that bit of anxiety, you know, what our heart really wants us to do. And that, you know, those few things that we're that keep us from doing that are what kind of really prevents that. So 10% of fear can, you know, block 90% of where my life could go. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that's like we're spending a lot of time worrying about what might happen and ruining the little, those lovely times that are really rare when everything's going fine.
That's it. And you know, we worry about 99% of the stuff we worry about, when we think about it and look back on our lives, never happened. So we look back and we said, God, I spent all this time worrying, you know, about this, and, you know, I'm always fine. It's where we manifest where our life goes through our mind, right? And if we let that happen, we're not going to die, you know, unless something crazy happens to us. But we always seem to think, well, what if I leave this job and do this, I could lose everything. I won't be able to pay my rent. I'll be out in the streets. You know, that's that kind of heavy thing that just overcomes us, like that fear and anxiety really rules our life. And it, you know, through mindfulness and understanding and understanding that, you know, look, these things are going to pass. You know, look at the old George Harrison album, All Things Must Pass. If you looked at what happened to his life when the Beatles quit and Eric Clapton stole his wife, you know, he's sitting there in the yard, but he's cool, right? You know, I mean, it's that, accept what's coming new, you know, something's always coming around the corner. So that's kind of where that is, and what that's about is overcoming that is really hard to do, right?
Yeah. And part of what you said is that how I trained myself out of severe anxiety was telling myself things are going to happen whether you worry about it or not. So why would you ruin good times worrying about things that might never happen? And I can talk myself down. And now I just don't worry as much. You know, I don't, not nearly like I used to. So I think reminders like that are really helpful, that, you know, life is full of change. The one thing we can count on is constant change. Sometimes it's subtle. Sometimes it's huge.
Exactly. And that's why I call this book A Ladder of Ascension from the Mind. As you go through the six parts, it kind of opens up, get to the awakening, and then the three breaths of the seven chakras meditation. And it's all about that kind of balance. You know, when I can go through, people think meditation are about, you know, finding a place, quiet, a place with my candles and my Buddha and my music, you know, and just kind of erasing the day or whatever. That's part of it, but that's not, meditation is work, right? Meditation yoga, which is in early days, yoga was mind exercise, union of the science of the supreme, union with science of the supreme. You know, it developed in stretching and all these poses, but originally yoga was mind work, right? And I try to cycle up through the seven chakras, and you can see, you know, what just one or two of those are out of balance. Those seven key points of my life, it wrecks everything, right? So there's those kind of rare times when they're all in balance, you know, and your Kundalini snake rises, and that's where we want to be, right? And that's kind of what this book is all about, is kind of understanding what that is, understanding how the world, the pressure of the world really works on us, and it's never going to change. In that prime of where you're talking about, I like to say, there's always been a war. There was a war yesterday. There's a war today. There's going to be a war tomorrow. There's never going to be peace on earth. There's never going to, you know, this is designed for us, something for us to overcome and ascend. That's what samsara is. It's a place that's never going to change. And how many of us spend our life thinking we're going to change the world or fix the world or whatever? But we're a wreck ourselves, right? Really, what the Buddha said was the only person we can really change is ourselves. Once we change ourselves, things open up.
It's all you can change is yourself. Yes. But if enough of us change ourselves, then things do have some significant change. But I agree with you. I have to remind people a lot. There's a lot of people who are very fearful and living in hopelessness. Like, this is not the worst time in history. It's a bad time. It's a difficult time, but it is not the worst time in history. I have studied plenty of history. I know that's not true. So we,
you know, I grew up in the 70s, Ivory, when it was just after Vietnam. But I look back on it now, and the music was so great. We were having so much fun, but people, it was just the end of the world, you know. And I don't know if you get a million texts a day, but I think it's the last five elections now have been the very most important election of our life. And no, they're not. Quit bugging me. It doesn't matter at all. You know, I don't care who wins, man. I'm gonna stay in my lane, you know.
I just keep working on myself. You know, I mean, that's right. I don't waste a bunch of time. I'll help people who want help, but they got to do the work. Let's go on to this. This is really something I know the audience is going to want to hear about. False free will. What does that mean? What's perceived free will?
Perceived free will is what goes back to your initial question of what is samsara, really. Perceived free will is the belief. That, for instance, in the West, I wrote my book. I'm an Eastern spiritual thinker in the Western world, right? And there's great, there is just such great wisdom and enlightenment in Eastern spiritual thinking. But when it translates to the West, it's kind of seems something that's far distant or very different from how we are, right? It's almost, in the West, we say we're free, right? We live in a free world. We are not free. You know, we spend 90% of our time busting our butts every day to make a few dollars so that we can save up and go on a vacation for 2 weeks. And man, it's great for that, you know, 6 days. But when it's time to go back home, that little time clock starts going back in our head. And I get pulled back in the world. I got to go back to work and I've got to do this. If we're not lucky and we don't absolutely love what we do for a living, which I'm beginning to think and is the point of life, right? Find your art and do it.
Yes.
How many of us, you know, don't do our art for 90% of our lives and we only do our art for 10% of our lives? It's finding that reversal, right? We're not really a false free will is the whole idea of what Mara does and what samsara does. I said, you know, we take one step closer to him and he steps one step back, right? And these desires, so in the Dharma, you hear a lot about desire, right? It's built on desire. Our desire, I want a bigger car. I want a house. I want a different house. I want a boat. I want this. I want this beautiful person in my life, or I want this. These desires pull us towards things. I have a quote from a great, there's an author named Rachel Pollack. She was a tarot reader. She wrote a book called 78 Degrees of Wisdom. It's a book about the tarot. And she wrote a line. I used her quote in the book, and it says, you know, we have this, the problem with our world is it's a dualistic world where we have to make a choice of either this or that, like the Two of Swords card, right? I'm blindfolded. I got to make this choice. Our minds don't want to make that choice. They want to go in all directions at once. That's nirvana, right? But we live in this physical world where we have to choose between this or that. We make a choice to go this way, and maybe it's good for us, but we're always be haunted by that way we didn't go, right? that's kind of this free will. We really don't have free will when we have to make a choice of this or that in everything we do, right? Mm-hmm. And those choices, like the swords in the tarot, just start, you know, if you go up the ladder of that 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 of swords, there's no good ones in there. You know, these are the heavy actions of our life. So it's almost this principle of, you know, you think about retirement. I don't know anybody, you know, who's aged in your life and they, you know, they've been saving up for their retirement and they did it right. But you know, you're at the end, that you're close to the end of your life. Right. And then how many people do you know who retire and then 6 weeks, 6 months later, they're back to work, right? Because we have this vision in our mind that one day I can be free, right? And then we get there and freedom is not really freedom. That's kind of this false free will that we think is we're programmed, whether it's on TV or by our political leaders or our teachers or educators. Even the great Bodhisattva Manjushri, I have this in the book, even our parents, they love us and they want the best for us. But what do we do to our kids? We train them to be just like us and go on the same painful pathway that we've gone on, right? Subconsciously, we know there's something wrong with it, but in our conscious field, we keep going because that's what everybody else is doing, and that's the direction of the world that it goes. It's almost like a magnet that pulls us towards this decadent ending, right? And we're all caught in it. And part of that little way out of the wheel is what the Buddha did. You know, he got rid of all of his desires and wants and needs. The more that you get rid of, I'm finding in life, the more free you become, right?
Yes. Oh, yes.
I used to have a big career and a big house and lots of things. And that's pressure, pressure, pressure. As we deconstruct our lives and let those things down, man, I'm down to just doing the things that I love. And you know, you got to make some adjustments down, right? I can't go out to eat 5 times a week anymore. I can't go on, you know, on these wild trips or whatever. But finding happiness in your home and your little place in the world, I've got a line. You don't need to go to Giza or Burma or any of these places to find your spirituality. You can find right on your coffee table, in your couch with your little candle and your medications. The whole world, that's nirvana, is right there. That's freedom.
Absolutely.
That is free will.
It's kind of like you can't ever escape yourself. And that's true. You can't escape that within you. Is the path to freedom within you, is the path to finding passion, you know, and I think it is critical to find something to do if you're still working and you want to work, find something you're passionate about, because I don't ever want to fully retire.
No, me neither. I can't.
People think I'm crazy, but I love what I do so much that I would miss it. I know I would. I'll cut back, but I don't want to quit doing my work. I just love it. So let's go into this part three here. I like this idea you brought up, that enlightenment comes first through a new realization and then an awakening through a reverse engineering of our minds based on that newfound realization. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, this is there's something you just said just a 30 seconds earlier. I quote an author called Takasaki in the book a couple of times, and he talks about something called the seed of Tathagatagarbha. And one of my things on the book is to not use words like Tathagatagarbha. You know, everything you read about Buddha that goes back to the, you know, everybody has to say exactly where it came from. I try to get rid of all that and just what it is. But what that is it says that the, you know, kind of the difference between a Judeo-Christian spiritual belief and an Eastern, let us say, Buddhist spiritual belief is that, you know, God is a dualistic thing in Judeo-Christian, right? We're down here, God's up there. It's two separate things. In Eastern spiritual terms, we are God, right? It's inside every one of us. Buddha simply means awakened one. That's Buddha, right? And we all have the opportunity to be a Buddha, to be Buddha. It's called the seed of, it's a little seed within us that once we find it, it enlightenment happens and it lights up and there's almost no going back, right? And that seed starts in the Four Noble Truths, in the Eightfold Path of Righteousness, those things that you see in Buddhism. The Three Jewels of Buddha is a cool thing to talk about, right? The Three Jewels of Buddha are 1, the Buddha, 2, the Dharma, and 3, what's called a Sangha, right? So the Buddha himself is almost like, you know, when you see, you know, I was raised in Judeo-Christian, you know, structures all my life and always thought, I'm not, you know, never want to deal with that. But something about that Buddha that you see, he's just kind of sitting there and he looks so, there's something peaceful about it, right? That's almost like a the beginning of that seed, right? And when you start to kind of dive into what the Buddha actually said, right? That's the Dharma. The Dharma is kind of a straightforward way of talking, and pretty much the Dhammapada, these are the words of the Buddha, is all about kind of this samsaric principle that we think we want all these things, but they all bring us to ends that have unfulfilling ends, and then the desire takes us to somewhere else, right? This car, or this person in my life, or this house, it wasn't good enough, so now I need another one, right? And I start the process all over, and this kind of unending thirst, right? Once we realize that, you know, that desire is part of the problem, right? We don't understand fully enough how desires, how they pull us towards things and how to put the reins on those desires, right? Maybe if I keep doing this over and over and it keeps bringing me to a place that I don't like, why don't I just stop doing that?
Right? What you think?
So, yes. And the Dharma is all about understanding these, you know, whereas, say, the Bible will tell you this is a sin, don't do it, right? The Dharma tells you, okay, these are the five hindrances are lust, anger, laziness, skepticism, and angst, right? Lust is a form of desire, right? A hunger for things, right? And it tells us this is what it draws us to. This is where it comes from, right? If you know, there's a balance to everything, like for anger, the balance is happiness, right? If I'm always angry, if I find myself to be an angry person all the time, then I can simply balance that out by stop doing that and do something that puts joy in my life, right? That's that balance. This is a form of enlightenment that comes through the Dharma. And that's kind of that seed. That's first finding that enlightenment, right? And once you start to understand these and start to think differently about our desires and, you know, maybe these desires that I've been taught, these things I've been taught all my life to do are not in my best interest, right? So we can start curbing that over in different directions and find new pathways for our life that are better than our old life. That's enlightenment, right? And then first is a form of enlightenment, and then using those principles, those dharmic principles, to guide ourselves in our meditations and our mindfulness during our life. That's kind of that progress part of that, right? That's where it becomes more of a way of life for us. So Dharma itself is kind of that central thing. It's where enlightenment meets, you know, that work that we do, as you said earlier, they've got to do the work, right? So it's understanding how that work helps us and the benefit that we get from doing that work. That's the awakening, right? That's the change of our life. So that's kind of what that's all about.
Very interesting. I remember, I don't even know who gave it to me, where I got it, but reading the entire book of Buddha in my 20s. And it was probably the first book I'd read, which now it's one of many of different religions books. And I think the more we read about that, the more enlightenment we receive. Expansion of the mind.
Exactly. You know, my background really is I started out as a songwriter when I was young, wanted to be a rock star. And then, you know, that obviously doesn't work out at about 30, you know, so I turned to my writing, you know, stuff. And then I found existential philosophy when I was about 40. You know, when we're about 40, we've learned enough about life and we can really start learning. That's kind of my assessment of life so far. But I really sought hard for about 15 years through existential philosophy, philosophers like Friedrich Nietzsche and Jean-Paul Sartre, and I love them. But there's an emptiness to philosophy. You know, it's almost like that kind of samsaric, right? Or always kind of searching for that one thing. And I found myself trying to find out what the exact mechanics are of our inner being and maybe how we can tune that, and just ended up nowhere. Fortunately, I was an assistant editor on a book project for an old philosophy professor, and the Buddha was the Dhammapada was one of the books that she used. One part of my job was to track down her footnotes and get everything together. And I kept seeing these quotes from this book, and I said, this is right on time with everything I'm thinking. You know, I bought that book. It came. I read it page to page in 2 days, and that became the inspiration for this book. since then, I still love Meister Nietzsche and Jean-Paul Sartre and the French philosophers and the existentialists and all that. But that's almost just fallen by the way. When I found Darwin, this is the thing, right? This is the answer. It's almost where philosophy ends. I like to say in the 1500s, Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am," right? That's a famous philosophical statement. They could have just closed all the books right there, and that's philosophy's end, right? Where our mind, we think, everything is electrical. It's almost like a dream, right? And that's where Dharma and Eastern spirituality comes in. The Eastern spiritualists have known for a long time that we're reincarnate beings and we come back over and over, and our karma does affect us, and we evolve and devolve, based on our actions. Very different from how we kind of grow up and what we're taught here in the West. So I just, once I found it, it just has become the primary source, and that enlightenment, it just keeps growing. I don't know about you, but it just keeps, I'm working on volume 2 now and bringing in some Hindu stuff with Brahma and the Maya, which is very close to Mara. And it's just, it's like unpeeling that onion, right? It just keeps going. And that in itself is a form of nirvana, when I know that I can just keep going. And there seems to be a purpose resolved to it. Whereas in philosophy, there's a lot of random chaos, right? And trying to understand how that all comes together. So that's kind of where that sits with me. And it's really cool. I feel lucky to have found that kind of the answer, that we all seek, right? It's right here in the Dharma. And the beauty of it is the simplicity of Dharma. If you listen to actually the words the Buddha taught, and the fact the book I'm talking about is called What the Buddha Taught by Rahul Wapola. Buddhism, like any other religion, has been bastardized and twisted. And the Buddha got out of samsara and left. And they over time, they said this was a selfish act, right? And then we turn to what's called Mahayana Buddhism and the idea of the Bodhisattva, where I have to keep coming back over and over a million times if possible until everybody can go to nirvana together. That sounds very much like this samsaric wheel, right? Like that has come back into it. So I go back to the source of the words of what the Buddha actually taught. And that's where the gold is for me.
We're going to run out of time. And I want to be sure we talk about that exit point, that how do you get out of that wheel, Joe?
Well, if you look at it in the very center of the wheel, this is the thing that really grabbed my attention, is you have three characters chasing each other. You have the pig, which represents ignorance and greed, biting the tail of the peacock, which represents pride and envy. She bites the tail of the snake, who represents anger and spite. And the snake is biting the tail of pig, and you've got this circle going over. That's us. That's that each one of us is in the same human condition. And then you have these six levels, kind of these higher levels of existence and lower levels. From humans, we're kind of in the middle, and it goes up to what they call demigods, and then divas or gods, right? You can think of that as like a rock star, somebody who seems to have everything, Elon Musk, right? They live this kind of godlike existence. Down to animals are right below us, and then you have these hungry ghosts, upper and lower levels, kind of all this stuff. And we just run around and we go up and down. Something I'm really looking at now is I've got this little tarot sticker, right? And if you think of the old tarot, you've got three figures there. You've got a little devil, you've got a little a snake and a sphinx kind of all chasing each other around. There's so much synergy between the different, Egyptian magic and Buddhism and even Christianity and all that it all kind of fits in together. If you look at the top of the wheel, there's a little crack up there by one of Mara's hands and this little bitty cloud of smoke, and there's two clouds above the wheel, right? The Buddha stands to the one on the right above Mara's left shoulder, and he's pointing to what looks like a little chalkboard on a cloud on the other side over Mara's right shoulder. And there's four lines there, which represents the four noble truths. We all suffer. All things pass. Suffering itself too shall pass. Mindfulness and understanding that all things pass. That's where the enlightenment is, that mindfulness and understanding. Once we understand that, it's kind of, I like to relay it to it, a lot of people know Plato's allegory of the cave, right? The guy, the people are chained, watching the shadows on the wall. One gets free, he makes his way out of the cave, and he realizes it's the sun shining off a piece of glass in a river, and that's what they're seeing. That's their reality, right? He realizes that's not reality. The sun and this glass is reality. He tries to go back to the cave and tell everybody, hey, you're all crazy, and they think he's crazy, and they kick him out. You know, get out of here, you're nuts. So it's kind of escaping out of that thing. So just that mindfulness is what I call nirvana, right? And we find that through meditation. At the end of the book, you'll see the three breaths of the seven chakras meditation. This is my interpretation of meditation through chakras and how we can cycle through that. I give an idea of it. And that's that way out, right? We don't know. The Buddha didn't like to talk about things that we don't know about. You know, there's a famous parable where they're asking him, okay, if you're so smart, tell us what happens after you die, this stuff. And he says, it doesn't matter. What, that's the parable of the arrow. You have an arrow in you. We don't take it out, you're going to die. Oh, but who's the doctor and who shot me and why did, that doesn't matter. If we don't take the arrow out, you're going to die, right? That's taking that arrow out and understanding that there is a path of ascension, right? There is something bigger than this thing that has always just been grabbing my heart and pulling it away from where I want it to go. That's the freedom. And beyond that, we don't know, right? We don't know what the next level of ascension is. There's a lot of people who talk about reptilians and all that, you know, I don't know. Have you ever seen one? I haven't, you know.
I haven't seen a reptilian, no. I've seen a lot of things, but not that.
That's right. What I do know is that my, you know, my soul, my essence, my core of being can be a lot freer through enlightenment and that enlightenment through Dharma. That's just that first understanding is our first step out of there, right? Where we go beyond that, we can only imagine, but that in itself is the freedom, just that kind of change of mind, right? A new way of thinking, a new way of, you know, enlightening, pull me out of this angst and anxiety. And that's freedom. That's freedom of choice. Then we have some freedom as to where our mind goes, because I firmly believe, and you probably do too, we manifest our reality. What is in our minds is what we manifest, right? If I think I'm always going to lose, I'm probably going to always lose, right? If I believe I can win and I do the work to try, you know, the steps necessary to do it, I can win, right? In whatever we do. And I always say, just find your art. You know, we all have individually, whatever it is, we all have something inside of us that we always wanted to do as a kid, or we wanted to do, but got off on a different path. Find that, foster that, enjoy what you do every day. And that's nirvana. You know, that's the beginning of that exit for us from that wheel.
I love that. I think it's a great book. As I was reading it, I could feel, I think just more like an intuitive hit. Like, you had a lot of moments of illumination that led to this book and the ideas in this book, because I could feel it just reading it. So it had a lot of great ideas. I want to just show people your book once more, Mora Dawn, Buddha Rise, The Awakening. This is Joe Singleton. And Joe, where is your book available?
It's on Amazon.com. You can get it. It's on Amazon worldwide. And I love what you said, because if you know, that all comes from the third eye portion of my meditations. When we get to that third eye chakra, Ivory, I'm telling you, it's a transference of energy. I'm not writing these words most of the time. You know, I can't tell you how many times I have to text and email to myself and interrupt my meditation because some enlightening form of understanding. And that's the Buddha talking to me, right? We're in this together. This is our project together.
I was going to ask you that after the interview.
Yeah. No,
who is this coming through? Because I can feel that.
When you and that, I know I've written some bad books, man, and this came out and it's like what you're saying. I can't tell you how good it is to feel. People are reading this and saying, man, this reads amazing. I had a friend call me the other day and say, man, this is awesome. You know, I'm letting go of my anger. Like, when you hear people say that, that's not us, right? We're not that's the spirit. That's when you know you found your destiny and your lane, right? And when you cycle up, when you get to that sixth chakra, for me, that's where all of the magic happens, right? The crown, you know, when we get to the spirit, that's just kind of that rest point where everything, you know, cools. Volume 2 coming out, it's called Wheels of the Mind. I'm working at it now. It's more, you know, I spend 40 pages on that meditation at the end of this book. The next book is going to be just a dynamic opening of that whole process through cycling up through our our chakras. And it's really cool. It'll be a little step up philosophically. I wrote this book just to be an easy introduction, understanding to help people find, you know, that, and hopefully that can spark. And it already had in some people, and it's a beautiful thing, man. I really appreciate that, those nice words.
Well, I look forward to it. And I'm going to put a link. I'll find the link on Amazon and I'll put it in the show description so you can find his book easily. And thank you, Joe, for coming and being a guest on the show today. I really appreciate it. I look forward to it. It's been great. Next Sunday's topic is remote viewing. I'm going to tell you about my personal experiences with it. And I'm working on a guest to come talk who's done that with the government. We'll see if that can come through. But if not, I'll just tell you about my personal experiences and how it works. In the meantime, may your angels surround you. May your angels protect you every moment, every day of your life. I'll see you next week.
Namaste.
Arizona time for another enlightening episode.